This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is CoronaCast, a podcast all about the coronavirus where we answer your questions. Now, that music is actually a musical rendering of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, but we'll have more on that later. I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan. It's Wednesday, the 8th of April.
Norman, let's start by talking about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. What can we say about this at this stage?
Well, just need to say that we record CoronaCast a few hours before it's released, so we really can't talk in detail about Boris Johnson's condition, and we wish him well. Now, what we're seeing here is really a very typical path for somebody who's actually going to deteriorate pretty well to begin with, mildish symptoms. In fact, for a period, you feel really well, and then you start to decline. People might have seen the video that Mr. Johnson released a few days ago, where he really did look dreadful. And obviously he's got worse since. He looked in that video to me as if he had a low blood oxygen level. He's on the older side. He's 55, going towards the higher risk group. First tested positive, I think, on March 26th. And this is what's typical, which is the second week crash where you do decline. As I say, we can't really talk too much about it because we're speaking a few hours before you're hearing the CoronaCast. But this is the reason why we try and reduce the coronavirus in the community as much as possible, because it's relatively unpredictable who in the younger age groups get it, and they don't necessarily have to have other diseases or diagnoses. I've no idea what Boris Johnson's other medical conditions are, if indeed he has any. He looks pretty healthy to me. But it's pretty typical that when younger people outside the 70 plus age group get it, they don't necessarily have any risk factors. That's the scary thing about this.
Yeah, it's still pretty shocking when someone in such a prominent position is so unwell.
Yes, and they become a symbol for the problem. And of course, it makes the problem very much more personal. Anyway, as I say, we wish him well.
So CoronaCast is primarily a podcast that's all about answering audience questions, and we've got heaps to get through today. So first up, if soap and water kills the virus, why don't we just wash all personal protective equipment?
Good question. You can certainly clean the masks and those plastic masks. They can be cleaned with detergent. But a lot of PPE is disposable rather than reusable. So some personal protective equipment is reusable. So I think the mask is. Some forms of the gloves are, but most of the gloves are disposable. So you can't wash the gloves. Some people think you can wash surgical masks. I think the jury is out on that. But most of the clothing these days is, in fact, disposable. The manufacturers don't make it, they don't design it to be washed and reused, and you may destroy some of the protection in the gown, for example. Whereas some PPE is designed to be reused, and when you look at the Ebola epidemic and people in the field, you can see people being hosed down or disinfected after their session, and that is being, that is PPE being reused. And it's a common problem in healthcare when you have equipment which you're short of, but which is designed for one use and it's reused. It happens in other areas as well, and it's highly controversial as to whether or not you really can reuse it safely.
We've got someone else asking, if the acids in your guts kill the virus, then how come it's been detected in feces?
Well, I'm not convinced there's evidence that acid in the gut does kill this virus. There's no question that the fecal-oral route is a risk in this virus, meaning that it is in the feces, and you can, if you don't wash your hands after you've been to the bathroom, you can infect food, and the likelihood is that the food then can carry the organism into you. And I think what happens in the gut is either it resists the acid, it's hidden in food and gets through the acid environment of the stomach, or there's enough virus that just enough gets through the gut into the rest of the bowel, it allows to multiply. I don't think that people fully understand that. It's a very good question, but essentially there's a lot of bugs that can get through the acid in the stomach.
So countries around the world are all working really hard to contain the virus. Someone's asking, how did the Chinese contain the virus to just one province? Why has it spread so far across the world, but it doesn't seem to have spread through the rest of China?
Well, I think it has spread to other parts of China. I don't think it's just to Hubei province. It's just the Hubei province was the worst. And what they did was essentially lock down the province. They stopped people going in and out, and they ring-fenced Hubei province and essentially stopped travel. And that's how they contained it, in the same way as other countries have managed to contain it, including Australia. Our success in containing this virus so far, has been in containing overseas visitors and people who are carrying it from overseas. couple of spectacular failures on cruise ships, but nonetheless, we've been quite good, 8 out of 10 for our work on borders. And that's what the Chinese did very well, containing it to the province. But some did escape because people did go back to where they came from. And they've contained that by the traditional means of, I think they've isolated areas as well. They've gone for clusters. They've done intensive testing, contact tracing, quarantining, lockdown, the sort of things in a very aggressive way that would have been hard to tolerate in a country like Australia.
So sometimes when you're seeing photos and video from elsewhere in the world where there's been a lot of the virus, you see them spraying disinfectant in the streets. What are they actually spraying? What does it do?
Well, I think this is an unproven technique. They used to do this sort of thing when the plague hit in olden times. They did it quite a lot during the flu pandemic. And I think it's in the hope that they're going to knock out the virus in high prevalence areas. I think that, you know, it's a general spraying of the street. It's hard to imagine, unless there's a lot of people in the street with the virus, that it's actually going to be worth doing. What is worth doing is disinfecting high touch areas, so that you actually go around and railings, things that people touch a lot, ATMs, those high touch, high frequent touch areas are the things that are worth disinfecting. Whether or not you get a value for money from spraying disinfectant on the streets, I think is highly questionable.
So in some other countries like Japan and Sweden, it looked like they were doing really well. And then they're now seeing a rapid uptick in the number of people who have COVID-19. What has happened there? And is there a risk that it's going to happen here?
Well, I think Sweden had a bit of a hands-off approach to business as usual approach to the epidemic. As we've seen, that can be a very dangerous way to go. And if you're not testing a lot, I'm not quite sure what the testing regime was in Sweden, but if you're not testing a lot, you don't notice it, and it just grows under the surface and then bursts out because the fire gets fueled. If you are relaxed about this, or you think, well, we'll just let it go and let herd immunity develop so that we let that, it runs away from you much faster than herd immunity develops. And that's the situation you've got in across Europe and in the United States. And it's very hard to pull back under control once it gets off on you. So it could have been predicted that Sweden, for example, would see a problem. And hopefully it's not too bad and they'll be able to pull it back.
So will we see the same thing happen here in Australia?
If we did, it would be what people call the second wave. And the reason that we've got such great tail off in numbers is that overseas cases of COVID-19 have fallen right away. They're really declining fast. What's sitting there underneath that is a slow but steady increase, maybe tailing off, but slow but steady increase in community spread, either from overseas cases or unknown where you've caught it from. Now, that's the fuel for the future fire. And as we've seen in this pandemic, small numbers can become very large numbers very quickly. And so the nervousness of government and others is, if you let your foot off the brake too quickly without everything being in place, that will pour petrol on that fire and it could go exponential, because we've still got a lot of non-immune people in the community. So that's the worry here. So normally at this point in the CoronaCast, I talk about a new piece of research. But today, Tegan, you want to talk to me about something.
I do. I want to talk about that music that we heard a bit of at the start. Actually, let's listen to a little bit more of it now. It's actually a musical rendering of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and specifically of the spike protein, which is the part of the virus that allows it to attach to our cells. It's the spike that gives the coronavirus its name, its little crown. So it was made by musicians and engineers at MIT, led by Professor Marcus Bueller. And what they did was they assigned each amino acid, so the building blocks of the proteins, a note, and then things like the volume or the duration of the notes and the rhythm were derived for how the amino acids are arranged in space, because you often see them in like these curly helix shapes. And then the protein itself is actually like folded together and intertwined. And so that was reflected by intersecting melodies. So it's really pretty. I actually was listening to it in my headphones as I was working all day. But even though it sounds a bit frivolous, it actually has a potential scientific application. So Professor Bueller's pointed out that our brain's ability to process sound actually reveals details that we might miss using microscopes, because we're actually really sophisticated at untangling quite detailed sounds. And he hopes that this approach could even maybe be used to design drugs to fight the virus, where you might have a musical rendering of the virus and then you might be musically rendering different proteins. And if you found one that matches the melody and rhythm of the antibodies that could interfere with the virus's ability to infect, then that's where you could turn your attentions for drug development.
So if one of your kids is resisting practicing the violin, tell them they could hold the cure for coronavirus in their hands.
Precisely.
Exciting. It's crazy stuff.
Well, that's it for CoronaCast today. If you want to send in a question, go to abc.net.au/coronavirus. And a reminder, we now have transcripts for each episode on the CoronaCast website. And if you like this podcast, please tell a friend.
We'll see you tomorrow. Bye for now.
See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.